I want you to do two things for me, all right? Number one, and most important, take a deep, deep breath and relax. Number two, and I realize this could be contradictory, hang on to your hats, folks, because 2016 could be interesting. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. In Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdal. Monday, January the 4th. Great, as always, to have you with us, everybody. With the caveat that one day's trading does not repeat, not a trend make. This was, and there's pretty much no other way to slice it, an interesting way to start the year. The rout in China, rooted in lousy manufacturing news there and more worries about the worrisome Chinese currency, became a European rout, which became, as you know, a Wall Street rout. It's entirely possible the traders are going to make all that money back tomorrow because capitalism, right? But it's tough not to look at things and wonder about the near-term economic future. Marketplace's Tracy Samuelson explains exactly why.
Well, there's the obvious. China's the world's second largest economy. It's been a major driver of global growth in recent years. Dan Rosen is head of the China practice at Rhodium Group.
At its height, it was almost 50% of all growth when the rest of the world was receding due to the global financial crisis. But even typically, it's been 15, 20, 25% of all the growth on the planet the past decade.
And what kind of contribution will China put up in 2016? Nick Consonieri with the Eurasia Group says investors are seeing question marks.
Investors globally are just still very uncertain about how much lower, you know, the economy is going to go and how long it's going to take to get there. Really, the key theme is just this opacity and uncertainty.
And you're especially nervous if you're a country or company that sells lots of stuff to China.
China is the main trading partner for more than 100 countries in the world.
David Dollar is a senior fellow in the China Center at the Brookings Institution.
So a country like Chile that exports copper to China, Brazil, I believe, exports iron, you know, Mexico exports energy, that is creating problems for a lot of U.S. partners.
In other words, there are direct and indirect ways China affects the rest of the world. But Patrick Chovanec at Silvercrest Asset Management says the impact won't be uniformly negative.
When you look at companies that have been selling to the Chinese consumer, they're doing quite well. Chinese outbound tourism is booming. So the Chinese consumption sector remains fairly resilient.
So yes, there are plenty of ways a Chinese slowdown hurts the rest of the world, but that's just not the whole picture. Chovanec says there will be some winners amongst the losers out there. I'm Tracy Samuelson for Marketplace.
The armed standoff at the headquarters of a national wildlife refuge in Oregon continues today. Among that group's demands, they have named themselves Citizens for Constitutional Freedom, by the way. Among their demands is that federal lands in the West be turned over to state, local, and private ownership. There are a whole lot of layers involved with who owns what piece of dirt out here, so we asked Marketplace's Mitchell Hartman to unpack the economics of it.
The federal government owns just over a quarter, one in every 4 acres of land in the U.S. But go west, and it's a lot more. 81% of Nevada, roughly half of Arizona, Utah, California, Wyoming, Oregon, and Idaho. How'd we get here? Well, go way back.
Initially, Indian people owned and occupied North America.
Historian Patty Limerick at the University of Colorado says after U.S. independence, the federal government took over new land by treaty or conquest and then handed most of it over to homesteaders and railroads and the like. Then along came Teddy Roosevelt and the progressives. They warned that the country was running out of timber and wild areas. So the government kept most of the remaining land in the West to manage and preserve, and crucially for local citizens and companies to use for mining and timber and grazing.
A grazing right becomes like another form of property. You don't own the land, but you can pass that grazing right along as a piece of property.
And at that point, says Limerick, the distinction between public and private property becomes pretty fuzzy. The economics can be fuzzy, too, says political scientist Daniel McCool at the University of Utah.
Grazing rights, they're still very heavily subsidized. They pay a tiny fraction of market value.
McCool and other critics say the same is true of oil and coal leases and timber sales. They've been priced below market to help locals and multinationals make money and keep rural economies alive. And if states did take over ownership, would it be a boon to local ranchers and school budgets? McCool says no. The costs of land management would far outstrip the revenues generated. I'm Mitchell Hartman for Marketplace.
There was really only one question about Wall Street today. Wah-wah trombones or something else? We'll have the details when we do the numbers. The European refugee story popped back into the headlines today. Dateline's Stockholm, Sweden, and Copenhagen, Denmark. Both of those Scandinavian countries tightened border controls for migrants traveling north through Europe. The United Nations says more than 1 million migrants and refugees arrived in Europe last year, fully half of them Syrians trying to get away from the civil war in their country. Once they do get to relative safety, though, those refugees discover they have traded one set of problems, albeit a very dangerous and real set of problems, for more mundane but still actual difficulties. Our European correspondent Stephen Beard is just back from a visit to the city of Bradford up in the north of England to see how Syrians there are getting by.
A pet cockatiel called Shriek sings cheerfully in his cage. Cooped up in a tiny apartment in Bradford, Syrian refugee Bashar Farhat bought the bird for company. He needs it, he says. His closest friends, all members of the Syrian opposition, are now scattered around the globe.
Turkey, Lebanon, Germany, Sweden, France, you know, all over the world. So I felt that the Syrian body is pieces.
Dismembered. It's been dismembered.
Yeah.
A hospital doctor by profession, 31-year-old Bashar, was imprisoned and tortured by the Assad regime. Today in Bradford, he seems broken and lost.
Yeah, I'm not that happy for what's happening in Syria, the war, the killing. I don't feel that I really came here. I feel that a piece of me is still there.
Every morning at breakfast, Bashar listens to the Lebanese singer Fairuz, as he always did back in Syria. Desperately homesick, he admits he's not adapting well to his new life in Bradford. He's struggling with his English, and if he wants to practice as a doctor here, he'll have to resit his exams.
I think that, okay, I spent 10 years in medicine, and it's really worth to go back to this life and to practice medicine again, but I'm not sure. I'm not sure if that I will be able to.
There's a different mood at this falafel shop in the centre of Bradford. Helping to make and sell this traditional Middle Eastern food is another young Syrian refugee who's much more upbeat about his new life here.
I like it British. I like it England. I found this city is the best city for the Syrian.
20-year-old Ayam Al-Halabi arrived here last year with his widowed mother and his two brothers. The younger one is being treated for leukemia. The family's health care, accommodation, education and some living expenses are paid for by the British taxpayer.
I like British people. Really, I like it. And as I said, really thank you for the British people to receive us in their country.
But other refugees have found less to be thankful for in Bradford. The magnificent City Hall here is a reminder of Bradford's former prosperity. In Victorian times, it grew rich on textiles. Today, the place is clearly in decline. Much of it is dilapidated, and so is some of the refugee accommodation. Sara Hamsi, an architect from the Syrian city of Homs, has complained repeatedly to her landlord about a leaky roof, but he'll only replace the plasterboard ceiling. So you're still getting water coming through the ceiling?
Yeah.
And it's been very wet recently, lots of rain.
Yeah, and the weather is horrible here, horrible.
Because she's here on her own, Sara does not get anything like the welfare payments that refugee families receive. She says after paying her utility bills, she has only $125 a month for food.
I thank them, the government, because, you know, they give us the safety. They give many things, but maybe not enough.
Not enough money?
Not enough money. We need more.
Among local people here, there is some sympathy for the refugees. This city was the first to volunteer to take them in. But amid talk that many thousands might arrive, the welcome in some quarters is becoming a little wary.
You've got to ask whether there are any extremists coming over, you know, with the refugees, with the Paris bombings and that, some of them come in as refugees, so you need to do full security checks.
It needs a lot of thought, a lot of planning and a lot of funding, because it's got implications for schools, jobs, etc., as we know.
We need to make sure that we don't have an over-influx of sort of people, because we need to look after our own people, but certainly, if that's what's needed, that's what Bradford will do.
This city will play only a minor role in the Syrian refugee crisis, taking in several thousand at the most, while more than 4 million Syrians have fled their country. In Bradford, I'm Stephen Beard for Marketplace.
The automotive number of this Monday is $500 million. That's what General Motors is going to be investing in the ride-sharing service Lyft. Lyft gets the cash, of course. GM gets a seat on the company's board. But here's the thing. Lyft is all about people paying to take rides in somebody else's car, not buy a car of their own, right? So we asked Sally Herships to find out what gives.
Imagine ride-sharing services are like sodas. Uber is pretty clearly Coke, which makes Lyft.
I would say that Lyft has always been like root beer.
Harry Campbell runs RideshareGuy.com, a blog. He says root beer is great, but it's not always on the menu, like Coke is or Uber. Campbell is also a rideshare driver.
I've heard people get into a Lyft while I'm driving and they think it's an Uber. They don't even realize that the person that called it, you know, called a Lyft.
So Campbell says Lyft can use some of the $500 million it gets from GM to help market itself better. Matt Stover is an auto industry analyst with Susquehanna Financial Group, an investment bank. He says there's a lot of potential in this deal for GM, too.
Number one, it allows for them to get more return on the investment of building a car.
Part of the deal is that GM gets to rent its cars, used ones, to Lyft drivers. That's the short term. The long term, GM can figure out how to design cars for the future, when more buyers may be rideshare drivers.
Yeah, I mean, there's certain vehicles that are probably going to be better and more amenable for the drivers.
Ed Kim is an analyst with Auto Pacific, a market research firm. He says for GM, there's an even longer term play here.
We see that there is a significant demand among consumers to give up the act of driving entirely.
Kim says if the future means driverless cars, a deal with Lyft would help GM prepare now. In New York, I'm Sally Herships for Marketplace.
New bans on what we think of as styrofoam containers took effect in the District of Columbia and Montgomery County, Maryland on New Year's Day. Those cups and clamshells have been falling out of favor since Berkeley, California outlawed them back in the 1980s. The New York Supreme Court overturned New York City's ban last year, but restaurants in Seattle and San Francisco and Miami Beach are among those free of plastic foam. Marketplace's Amy Scott has that story.
The original styrofoam was patented by Dow Chemical in 1944.
One of the most striking of the many plastics so useful today, this one is made of polystyrene, which is processed from coal and oil.
But what we think of as styrofoam cups and takeout containers are actually made from a similar material called expanded polystyrene.
So we've just sort of latched onto the name styrofoam and applied it to cups and plates and cafeteria lunch boxes, but they're not technically styrofoam.
Douglas McCauley is a marine scientist at the University of California, Santa Barbara. He says that container we use for a few minutes and discard sits in landfills for hundreds of years or ends up in rivers and oceans where it acts as a sponge for toxic chemicals and is often mistaken for food by fish and sea turtles. McCauley says recycling it is too expensive.
It's feasible. It's technically feasible, but it is not economically rational to do that.
Juan Amaya was working the counter at Don Juan Restaurant in Washington, D.C. on the day the ban took effect. He says the Central American restaurant switched to brown biodegradable containers for its takeout pupusas and fried plantains.
We actually started doing like a smooth transition before the effect came in, so everybody could get used to it.
The American Chemistry Council, which represents plastics manufacturers, says those alternatives can be 2 to 5 times pricier, but some companies have found it more expensive not to switch after pressure from customers. Big chains like McDonald's and Jamba Juice recently have ditched polystyrene cups in favor of paper. I'm Amy Scott for Marketplace.
Coming up, from the moment you start working on an idea, there's a sense that you're working in the early stages of making a movie.
Think little yellow blobs that talk funny, all right? But first, let's do the numbers. You knew it, right? You knew it. Wawa's. All right, good. The Dow Industrial is off 276 points today, 1.5%, closed at 17,149, did the blue chips. The NASDAQ off 104 points, 2%, 4903. The S&P 500 down 31 points, 1.5%, 1.5% is another way to say that. Ended things at 2012. The Dow, I should tell you, was off as much as 467 points in morning trading after the Shanghai Composite Index closed down 6.9%. Worst first day of trading, by the way, since 2008. We told you about General Motors' deal with Lyft earlier in the program. The company also named its first female chairman, current CEO Mary Barra. Investors, I guess, didn't care for that. GM stock declined 2%. Today, bond prices rose. The yield on the 10-year T-note fell to 2.24%. You're listening to Marketplace.
Behind every successful business is a story, and some of them might surprise you. Like how Chobani's first yogurt factory was discovered on a piece of junk mail. Or how the founder of the multi-million dollar cosmetics brand Drunk Elephant was told by everyone, including her own mother, that the name sounded like a dive bar. On the podcast How I Built This, host Guy Raz talks to founders behind the world's biggest companies to learn how they built them. In each episode, you'll hear entrepreneurs share moments of doubt, failure, and how they were able to overcome setbacks on their way to the top. How I Built This is like a masterclass in innovation and creativity. A how-to guide for navigating life's challenges from the people who've done it all. Follow How I Built This wherever you get your podcasts. Listen early and ad-free right now on Wondery Plus. For more business content like this, listen on Wondery, the destination for business podcasts. With shows like How I Built This, Business Wars, and many more, Wondery means business.
This is Marketplace. I'm Kai Rizdahl. Shares of Whole Foods did relatively well today, off a mere 0.7% on an otherwise dismal day for equities. 2015 was a rough one for the organic retailer. Sales were down as consumers found cheaper options at Costco and Walmart, and it was hit by an overcharging scandal in New York City as well. The company says it's in the process of getting back on top, lowering prices, doing more marketing, and counting on technology to improve the customer experience. Ashley Milne-Tite has that story.
At this Whole Foods in New York City, you think more about human help than the technological kind. I'm with J.P. Eggers, a professor of management at NYU Stern School of Business. We've only been inside a moment, but we've already spotted 8 employees, and their handiwork shows too. We make our way to the colorful salad bar, and instead of sloppy overflow, there isn't a beat out of place. Eggers says if this were a salad bar in another supermarket,
it would probably, by the end of the day, be a complete mess, right? And then someone would just come in the night and clean it up. But it's here. They're here on a regular basis.
Keeping everything looking neat. Eggers says it's this kind of attention to detail that makes Whole Foods stand out from its cheaper competitors.
The whole idea is this emotional kind of connection that they build between you and the store that makes you feel guilty if you go somewhere else, that makes you desire to go back. It makes you feel happy when you're there.
Whole Foods wants to build on that connection. It hopes technology will deepen its relationship with customers. Jason Beekel is the company's chief information officer.
We're refreshing a vast majority of the technology that we use to run the company, interact with our customers, support our team members, and run our supply chain and merchandising.
Whole Foods is revamping its outdated point-of-sale system so customers can check out faster and take more advantage of things like coupons. And it's experimenting with a self-service kiosk in some stores, so you can use an iPad to order your sandwich and customize it just how you like. Now, there's some evidence people order more when they serve themselves. And in fact, that's what happens when Whole Foods customers order groceries online using Instacart.
We've actually found that our basket is actually significantly higher for Instacart orders than what it is in the store.
With the kiosk, he says it's too early to tell if people are digitally pigging out.
But it ultimately might have a customer who felt like they didn't have time to wait in line to, you know, quickly go place the order, do some of their other shopping, and then come back and grab their juice or coffee or sandwich or burrito.
So it keeps customers around who might otherwise give up during the lunch rush. Beagle says the kiosk isn't replacing staff, at least not yet. There's still someone nearby if a customer needs help. Brian Yarbrough is a research analyst with Edward Jones. He says the technology upgrades will definitely make the stores run more efficiently. Still, he says Whole Foods has also said it'll cut costs without being that specific.
I do wonder where all these cost savings are going to come from Whole Foods, and I do have a little concern if it comes out of a customer-facing type environment. So basically in the store, so if you start taking labor out, that can have a big impact, and especially for a retailer like Whole Foods that is so customer service focused.
It's the staff who've kept Diana Coatney coming back to her local Whole Foods. She lives in Capitola, California. She has young twins who used to go shopping with her all the time. Then the family moved away for a year. After they moved back, she returned to Whole Foods, and a staff member there surprised her.
Somebody that I didn't recognize but recognized me and the kids referred to them by name the first time I went back into the store. And I didn't recognize this staff person. So I'd been gone for a year and they still knew my kids' names.
She says no technology can replace that kind of human touch. I'm Ashley Milne-Tite for Marketplace.
I'm going to go just a little ways out on a limb here and guess that it's better than even money, that whoever you are, almost wherever you are, with or without children, you have at some point in the past couple of years crossed paths with a minion. Many minions, probably. Those little yellow blobs of the Despicable Me movie franchise with overalls and eye goggles speaking gibberish. Little yellow blobs that are making millions and millions of dollars for Universal Pictures and the company that invented them, Illumination Entertainment. Chris Melendondri runs Illumination. Chris, thanks for being here.
Very nice to be here.
You are the CEO of Illumination. You founded Illumination. But what is your role in the creative process at the company and wrangling all these creative people who are a notoriously difficult bunch to manage?
You know, my responsibility, it's kind of an old-fashioned view of producing, which is it starts at with the inception of the idea, and it runs through the entire making of the film, which, you know, involves the writing of the film, the assembly of all the various participants, and it takes us all the way through to the marketing, the release of the film, and the afterlife of the movie. So it's all inclusive. But as much as I'm present, the magic in the films, I don't believe, comes from me. I believe that comes from our directors and our artists, and I'm the enabler.
Yeah, but we should say, you know whereof you speak. I mean, you've been around for a while. You were involved in and did Ice Age and Robots and all of those. I mean, it's not like Despicable Me was your first hit.
No, it's a great sort of Hollywood sort of moment, which was going from one of the industry's biggest financial failures to my subsequent film being Ice Age becoming one of the most profitable films in 20th Century Fox's history.
Well, tell that story. You lost $100 million worth of Rupert Murdoch's money, for crying out loud.
Yes. I mean, it was the second animated film that I was involved with called Titan AE. And it was one of those films that, you know, like most films, start out with great intentions and high ambition, but it never quite came together and absolutely crashed. And News Corporation wrote down $100 million on the back of that failure.
What's that like?
It is exceedingly lonely.
Yeah.
The best part about it is that for me, I had lived with the perception that a massive failure would actually kill me. And I realized that I was still breathing in the aftermath. And there was actually something, you know, strangely inspiring about that.
You run this company. You have said quite lean that you want the ratio of developed projects to produced projects to be quite low. How do you keep that going? How do you keep everybody firing when you're trying to do that?
Well, it allows you to operate with the assumption that everything that you're working on is actually a movie. Right. And it takes you out of what is a development process that for many years became almost its own industry within the industry, but lots of things that were being developed, most things, never saw the light of day. So I actually find that the low ratio, we've been operating at about, for every, I'd say, 1.5 films that we develop, we make one. When you're in that realm, from the moment you start working on an idea, there's a sense that you're working on, you're working in the early stages of making a movie.
You have a favorite?
A favorite film?
Yeah.
The first Ice Age and the first Despicable Me.
Yeah.
They're the films that, you know, have introduced me to characters that I still, you know, that I feel extremely bonded with.
Chris Meledandri is the CEO of Illumination Entertainment. Chris, thanks very much for your time.
Thank you.
Ba 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 na na. Ba 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 na 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 na. Ba 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 na na. Ba 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 na na na. Ba 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 na na. Tokari no potato rika ni maro manika no tika.
I personally love those guys, I got to tell you. All right, this final note on the way out today. You remember we started with capitalism and the vagaries thereof, China and global contagion and all that. Here with the counterexample that proves the rule about the vagaries of capitalism, that is. You've got two of the world's top 10 oil producers, Saudi Arabia and Iran, at each other's throats, diplomatically speaking anyway. So oil today, both major benchmarks, West Texas Intermediate and Brent North Sea Crude, off at the close. That would be the law of supply and demand right there. As I said, they might get it all back tomorrow, but today the Dow was off 276 points, about 1.5%. The NASDAQ down 104 points, 2%. The S&P 500 down 31 points, 1.5%. Our daily production team includes Tommy Andres, Bridget Bodner, Mukta Mohan, and Daisy Palacios. I'm Kai Rizdal. Let's do it all again tomorrow. All right? This is 8 p.m.
All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.